and being brought along by the CIA. That's a part that the major media has totally dropped down the memory hole, and we never hear about it.
Michael Parenti, author of The Culture Struggle. And that does it for today's broadcast. If you'd like to get a DVD copy of the broadcast or see the transcript or listen by audio stream or podcast at video or audio, you can go to our website, democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Shufo Dokuduce, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Aaron Mate, Jen Utes, Mike DeFilippo, Nick Marsilio, and Miguel Noguera are engineers. Thanks also to Angela Alston, Becca Staley, Hugh Grant, John Randolph, Jerome Bourgeois, Jose Miranda, Tori Townsend, Nicole Salazar, and Samantha Chamblee. If you want to sign up for our daily headlines and news segments, you can go to our website, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
And you're listening to radio station WUSB in Stony Brook. It's 6 o'clock. Time once again for Off the Wall. Okay, all right. Oh, boy, what a crazy entry that was. Everything was going in slow motion on the way here, you know. Everybody that needed to get out of my way was just going so slowly. I got stuck behind a bus, made it in here with like 30 seconds to spare. And the thing is, you can't run that last mile. You can't, because if you do that, you're going to be all out of breath. And then that's going to show when you're talking, and it's just going to make things all the more difficult. So I had to just hope. I had to hope that Amy didn't end early tonight, and fortunately she did not. But boy, you know, I was listening to Democracy Now! On the way over here, as I often do, and, you know, not being able to go fast enough and hearing about all the stupidity in the world and what's going on in Los Angeles and with guns and things like that. It just, all that bottled up together makes you really, really frustrated. Which can be a good thing. I suppose frustration can lead to construction of some sort, or maybe destruction and then reconstruction, something along those lines. So I'm not one for masking frustration or avoiding it. I guess confronting it head on, while not very pleasant, can sometimes be productive. I don't know if this is one of those times, though. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you. Happy to be here for another edition of Off the Wall. And we just keep beating the odds, don't we? This is not going to be the special North Korea show. I'm sorry. I am planning one. I'm putting one together. There's just so much material to go through and so many other things I have to do, such as work on the magazine and get the grass cut and things like that. It's just a question how many hours there are in a day, and despite my repeated requests, that number seems to remain at 24. Don't know what you have to do. No North Korea show this week, but we will be discussing North Korea, which I returned from recently, and various other things in the world. I guess we can discuss it on this show, but this won't be the special features that I was planning. And of course, you're welcome to write to us, otw@2600.com. And for those who don't know, OTW stands for Off the Wall, the name of this program. All right. I'd like to do something a little bit different tonight. Rather than just launch into a tirade about how everything in the world sucks and how all these bad things keep happening, we will get to that. Don't worry. We will get to that. I'd like to just sort of step aside a little bit and acknowledge some things, which I think are really, really cool. Every so often you have to do that. You just have to sort of stop and, I don't want to say smell the roses. I don't want to say that. What do I want to say? Just stop and take it all in, you know, and realize, wow, some of the things going on in this world are pretty cool, pretty interesting. And I had something like that happen to me a few weeks ago. I've been meaning to talk about this for a while, but then the whole North Korea thing happened, and I was in Austin, and all sorts of... It happened a while ago. It really did. Basically, just to set the stage here, you may have heard of a particular brand of whiskey. Yeah, this is going to be a good story. A particular brand of whiskey known as Johnnie Walker. Now, I don't know a whole lot about things like this. I've always meant to study it. I've always meant to really devote some time to learning about alcohol, but never quite found the time. But what I learned through talking to a number of people over the past several months is just the whole kind of history of the Johnnie Walker Scotch label or whiskey label. And I think we've all heard of something called Johnnie Walker Red. And it's just a brand of whiskey. That's all it is, really. Never really meant much to me. In fact, I'm going to look at Wikipedia here, the source for all information. And I find that Johnnie Walker Red Label is what it's called. It's a blend of grain whiskey and malt whiskey. It is the best-selling whiskey in the world and the only Johnnie Walker product marketed with mixing in mind. It's 80 proof. Okay, but it turns out that there's a whole big color-coding scheme going on here. Yeah, I didn't know about this beforehand. In addition to Johnnie Walker Red, there's something called Johnnie Walker Black. Johnnie Walker Black Label. Now, that is a blend of as many as 40 whiskeys, each aged at least 12 years. And supposedly, according to Wikipedia, this was the favorite scotch of Winston Churchill. Mm-hmm. All right. It continues. There's something called Johnnie Walker Swing. I don't know. This is a kind of different name for the distinctive bottle in which an irregular bottom allows it to rock back and forth. Okay, that's just kind of silly. There's Johnnie Walker Green Label, which is a vatted malt whiskey that consists of a blend of about 15 individual single malts, the signature malts being Talisker, Craganmore, Linkwood, and Kale Ela? I can't tell if that's an L or an I. Kale Ela, I guess is what that's called. I wish I could speak like a professor about whiskey, but I can't. Anyway, that's aged 15 years. It's 86 proof. Okay, now you have Johnnie Walker Gold Label. There's a reason why I'm telling you all this. Trust me. Johnnie Walker Gold Label, it's a rare blend of over 15 single malts, including the very rare how do you pronounce that word? Why does such a word exist? Clenellish, I guess, is the way to say it. Clenellish malt. It was derived from Alexander II's blending notes for whiskey to commemorate Johnnie Walker's centenary. I don't know if Alexander II was commemorating the centenary. I don't think so. His original efforts were thwarted by a shortage of these malts following World War I. As stated on the bottle, it is aged 18 years, 80 proof. You know, Alexander II might have been doing that then. You sort of think that Alexander II had more important things to do than commemorate Johnny Walker's centenaries. Yeah, it's even a tough word for me to say. Okay, so now we arrive at the heart of the story. Johnny Walker Blue Label. Yeah, Johnny Walker Blue Label. This is the ultimate. And I had no idea about any of this up until very, very recently. Johnny Walker's ultimate blend. Every bottle is serial numbered and sold in a silk-lined box, accompanied by a certificate of authenticity. Although no age is declared, it is believed many of the whiskeys blended are aged for 50 to 60 years. And it's 86 proof. So that is probably the lifetime achievement. That's what people strive for, is to have a taste of Johnny Walker Blue. And so a friend of mine who told me about a lot of this kind of thing, well, he was visiting, it was his birthday, I figured, why not? You know, let's buy a bottle of the Johnny Walker Blue. It's a special occasion, it'll be a fun thing to remember. And so I went to the local liquor store, and I asked, do you have any Johnny Walker Blue? And kind of a silence fell on the place. You could hear a pin drop. And I said, well, why, yes. Yes, we do. And the woman at the counter said that it wasn't on the shelves. I don't know why it wasn't on the shelves. They have all kinds of liquor on the shelves, all kinds of bottles of wine that are more expensive than my house. But for some reason, they keep the Johnny Walker Blue behind the cash register. So she had to make a point of getting it from there and writing up the receipt and all that kind of thing. It was cool. It was really kind of neat. And so my friend came over. We had several glasses of the Johnny Walker Blue. It was very, very nice. Very, very good taste. But I'm not going to get into a review of different kinds of scotch. The point is, what happened after this is where it gets kind of weird. Because we went out to a bar, not the same night. I don't want to give the impression that we just did nothing but drink. Another night, we went out to a bar, local bar. And as soon as I walk in the door of this local bar, literally the second after I walk in, someone comes up to me and says, hey, are you Emmanuel? I'm not used to that. You know, I'm not used to people coming up to me immediately and identifying me. You know? Being made, as happens in cop shows. Well, I said, yeah, I guess. What's up? And turns out this guy may be listening now as a listener to the radio show, has been a listener to the radio shows. But the thing that really got me was that he said, I'm a big fan of the Tripods. Now, the Tripods was a serial that we did way back in the early 80s on a show called The Voice of Long Island. It was repeated, part of it at least, was repeated on Brain Damage back, in, I believe, in the early 90s. And this guy actually remembered the very minor details, I guess is the best way to describe it. Once we had a show on Brain Damage where we interviewed the actors and actresses, a couple of them, from that serial. And he wanted to know if those people really existed or if it was just Mike Juhas, my former co-host, and myself doing the voices, as was long suspected. And he even remembered the name given to the actress who played Kathy Tripod, the name being Blanche Forthright. I cannot believe that somebody would actually have this information stored in their head, ready to spit it out at a moment's notice, seeing somebody that they believe to be me. I mean, that was just incredible. It was an unbelievable experience that people actually pay attention to this. I think it's pretty cool. It sort of makes it all worthwhile. And I'll have a lot more on that in just a second. But the night got a little weirder. Not 15 minutes after that, I'm talking to the bartender to get a couple of drinks or whatever, and he says, "You know, I know you. I know you. I used to live next door to you when I was a kid." And I'm like, "Really? Okay. Oh yeah, you're that kid that used to live next. Wow, you're a bartender now. How about that?" And I was just amazed. This happened twice. Two people recognizing me for different reasons. The night went on, maybe an hour or so later, going up to the bar again, staggering to the bar, get another drink, right? So a woman standing there at the bar, and she says, so, and I'm like, okay, what now? And she asked me to my face, so how did the blue work out for you? How did the blue work out for you? Meaning the Johnny Walker Blue. She knew about the Johnny Walker Blue label. How did she know this? It turns out that was the very woman who sold it to me. She was in the bar, too. It's like this is your life. Everything coming together at once. Three people recognizing me for three completely different reasons. In the same place. You got to admit, that's kind of wacky. Kind of makes you realize that life can take a strange turn at any moment. So all these little factors coming together, learning about Johnny Walker and experimenting and trying out different colors, and going to a particular place at a particular time with particular people, it's also random. But to sort of back up on that story a little bit, we were talking about the tripods. Now, I've long wanted to tell this story about how we even started doing something like this. And I guess I sort of have to tell what we did, since it's so long since we did it. But back in the early 80s, when I was doing another radio show here called The Voice of Long Island, Mike Juhas was the co-host, and he had a propensity for doing voices, different voices. And I like to sort of write sketches and different material. And I had a lot of influence listening to the radio as a kid. I don't know how many people even do that anymore, but listening to the AM radio and hearing different, not talk shows, but just different styles of broadcasting. And some people that I really, really grew to admire and be influenced by was a comedy team known as Bob and Ray. And they did a radio serial called Merry Backstage Noble Wife. I don't know how many people even know what I'm talking about. But by listening to that as a kid, it sort of stuck in my mind. And when the time came where I actually had somebody who had talent as far as being able to produce different voices and somebody that I could work with, I figured, hey, why not do something similar to what those guys did? Namely, write a mock radio serial. I don't even know why I call it a mock radio serial, because it was a radio serial, but it was just, I guess, a bit silly. So what I'd like to sort of show you examples of how different things influence different other things. And start with an episode of that particular serial that we aired way back in the 80s here on this radio station. And we called it The Tripod Family. It was basically a story about a typical suburban family. Well, not so typical, because they had moved here from California, and there was a scandal, and all sorts of other things were going on in their lives. The point at which we pick up the story right now, not really typical lives, I guess. Harry and Kathy, Howard, I can't even get the names right. Howard Tripod and Kathy Tripod are on a train in France, a high-speed train in France, and they're on their way to the city of Nice. Why? So that they can replace a statue that they broke in their neighbor Charlie's house and return with it. I guess that's kind of where our adventures took us. And just listen to this episode, then I'm going to show you the kinds of things that influence that, and the kinds of things that influence that. And don't worry, we'll still have plenty of time to talk about how the world sucks, but for now, it's how the world is kind of cool. Let's go back, my God, 25 years.
Radio Free Long Island, in dissertation with the Three Village Tobacco Farms, proudly presents the exciting adventures of the Tripod Family, the story of one of America's most illustrious families and their struggle to find peace and happiness in the suburbs of Long Island. When I left Kathy and Howard last week, they were in France, and now they're on a train heading to Nice. And as we join them, we hear...
I sure hope we can find that statue, Kathy. I'd hate to return home to Long Island empty-handed.
It's not going to be easy, you know, Howard. There's only one of them left in the entire world. And the only thing we know is that it's located somewhere in the city of Nice.
Yeah. Oh, that's Nice, Kathy.
What?
Nice. The city's called Nice. It's spelled the same way as the word nice, but they pronounce it Nice over here.
Oh, well. I hope it's Nice town. I mean, a nice town.
Yeah, I've heard some pretty good things about it.
Yeah, Nice things about it.
But it's also a very big town. Now, are you sure you want to go through with this, Kathy? I mean, it's going to be next to impossible to find that statue.
Yes, I know.
I mean, just because you broke Charlie's statue doesn't mean we have to break our backs trying to find a replacement.
Yeah, I know, Howard, but Isn't it kind of exciting knowing that we're going to be on an important mission?
I guess so.
Speeding across a foreign land going 150 miles an hour in search of a precious statue?
All right, now, Kathy, let's not get carried away with this thing.
Oh, come on, Howard. Where's your sense of adventure?
I think it's back on Long Island.
This train in itself is enough to inspire anyone. It looks like something out of an Agatha Christie movie.
Oh, yes. You mean the Montauk Express. I mean the Orient Express.
Are you sure you don't mean the Midnight Express with Billy Hayes?
No, you're thinking of another film, Kathy. I think the Midnight Express was in Turkey, wasn't it?
Either that or in Greece. No.
One of those places.
Well, in any event, I feel as if I'm in one of those detective films.
I feel like I'm in an airplane. Look at that. I've never seen anything move so fast before. Everything's a blur out there.
Yeah, I think we're going around 175 mile an hour. Did you know that France has the fastest trains in the world?
Well, they're certainly faster than the ones in Long Island, don't you think?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. Howard, look. Talk about mysterious strangers. That man at the other end of the train, he's been watching us ever since we've got on board. And now he's walking towards us.
Oh, really? Should I turn around?
No, don't turn around. That's the number one rule in any film. Don't let a mysterious stranger who's watching you know that you're aware of the fact that he's watching you.
Oh. Well, then what should I do?
Here's a newspaper. You can read it.
It's in French, Kathy. I don't know.
He doesn't know you don't know French. Here, look like you're reading it. He's getting closer. Oh, this is so exciting.
It's a kind of excitement I can do without, Kathy. But, oh, yes. Can I help you, mister?
Excuse me, comrade. I could not help overhearing that you and your wife are in search of a particular statue in Nice.
Well, yes, we are, actually. We must have been talking pretty loud for you to hear us all the way over there.
The statue for which you are in need would not happen to be one of Charles de Gaulle, made by the famous Chinese statue maker Wally Chuberg. Would it?
Why, yes. That's the most extraordinary of all coincidences. Isn't it, Kathy?
Yeah. Ask him if he can help us, Howard.
Yes. Yes, of course. Do you know something about the statue, sir? Can you help us find it?
Well, that depends. I might, and I might not.
What does that mean, Kathy?
It's your cue, Howard.
My what?
Your cue. Now you have to say something that will get him to help you.
Oh, I see. My wife and I would appreciate it very much if you would tell us where the statue...
No, Howard. No. That's not how you do it.
What? I don't understand.
Look, if you were Maddox, you get this person to change his mind by flashing a wad of bills in his face. That usually works.
But I don't have a wad of bills, Kathy.
Oh, Howard, can't you do anything right?
And so Howard and Kathy continue their quest across France for the missing statue. Where will it lead them, and what will happen? You want to tune in next week when you'll once again hear me say, Radio Free Long Island, in coordination with the Three Village Tobacco Farms, proudly presents the exciting adventures of the Tripod family. For Radio Free Long Island and the Three Village Tobacco Farms, this is Don Topeka.
Oh, yeah, there you go. That's what we were doing back here many years ago, writing radio serials. But what I'd like to show you now is the inspiration for that, the inspiration for that particular radio series that we did way back called The Tripod Family. And I understand that humor changes over the years. I'm sure there are people out there smashing their heads into walls saying, my God, this is awful. How can you consider this even remotely humorous? And it's weird because listening to what we're about to listen to now, as well as, of course, what we just listened to, I find that taste varies very wildly. Some people really are into it. Some people really hate it. And it's very hard to explain. I mean, humor has always been very hard to explain. But I was one of the people who got Bob and Ray. I was one of the people who was just very much into just about everything they did, just their manner of speaking. And when I heard this radio serial back, I think in the 70s, when it was just basically two guys doing a whole bunch of different voices and making a story out of that and using sound effects on the radio to create a world inside your head, I was just so captivated and drawn in. And I can honestly say, were it not for me listening to those guys and deriving so many hours of entertainment and fun out of them, I don't think radio would have had the appeal that it still has to this day for me. And I wonder how many other people might have been inspired in the same way. So what I'd like to do now is play an episode from the 70s of what I heard on AM radio back in the day of the serial known as Mary Backstage Noble Wife. Now, there's a whole story behind that as well. It's a whole story behind how that got to be in the first place. But let's first listen to the story. In this particular episode of their serial, the Backstages, that's the name of the family, and they happen to be actors and actresses, Harry Backstage and Mary Backstage, I believe. And they're on their way to Boston. No, they're on their way to Meredith, New Hampshire. That's right. And they're performing in some kind of play, and they're driving a bus. And, well, just listen and you'll see. No, I'm sorry. That's the tripods again. Let's listen to the Backstages.
Next, Mary Backstage, Noble Wife. The story of America's favorite family of the Footlights and of their fight for security and happiness against the concrete heart of Broadway. As we join our friends today, they're aboard the old Mal Hallett bus driven by Harry, heading north on Route 3, bound for Meredith, New Hampshire, in the opening of their summer theater tour with Westchester Furioso. And as Harry carefully keeps the speed at 55 miles per hour, we hear...
What kind of a bus is this? A twin coach? Looks like.
I don't really know, Calvin.
I haven't made these in a long time.
No, I can tell that. This must be 30 years old anyway.
Still says Mal Hallett on the front. And look here, somebody in with a pencil or dark pen, ink or something, has written Canobie Lake Park, 1936.
Here's another one over here. Look, they wrote this in green chalk. It says Nuttings on the Charles, 1937.
Boy, do you know about that?
Oh, that band got around all right.
Sure they did. Look at this one here, Pittsburgh, Massachusetts. Oh, my goodness.
There's Norumbega Park. Keep your eyes on the road, Harry. Yes, I will. Greg, do you know how much
Commodore Ballroom was his year. They must have played the Commodore Ballroom.
Right. Do you know how much further it is to Meredith, Greg? Oh, Greg.
Yeah.
He's back with Barry there, Harry.
Oh.
I
was just going over the road map here.
Yes. Do you know how far we are away from our destination?
Well, we're up through Billerica now. I suppose we should be getting up Nashua in about half an hour or so. Then we'll be up into Meredith another 40 minutes after that. So I don't think we have too much time.
You gonna pass that truck, Harry? Well, I was going to try to. I think I've got room enough. I'll give him the horn again. Maybe that'll... Maybe he'll pull over.
Careful, don't want to get in any trouble now.
You better not pass, Harry. I think I see a police car back there, back of that car behind us.
All right, well, I'll
stay in line.
Be careful now while you're driving, Harry. We don't want any nonsense up there, do we?
Right-o, Mary. Hey, I think that police car is signaling you to pull over, Harry.
Yes, I think he is. He's not using his siren, though. Oh, yes, he is.
I don't think they want us. They probably want that car ahead with those four guys. Oh, no, they want us.
It's us. I'll pull over here.
Wonder what he possibly could want.
Yes, officer?
Yes. Where do you think you're going?
Why, we're going to Meredith, New Hampshire. We're the cast and crew of Westchester Furioso. I'm Harry Backstage, famous Broadway star, beloved idol of a million other women, and this is my wife, Mary.
We have kids in this town, and we want to keep them.
Well, of course you do.
Well, I mean, what would the kids be doing out on a major route like this, officer?
Right.
Hey, don't give me any of your lip. Well, you sound like wise New Yorkers to me.
Well, yes, we are from New York. That's why we'd like to go right on through, may we?
That's like waving a red flag at me, buddy.
What do you mean?
Well, giving me a lot of back talk and sass, and then capping it off with telling me you're from New York.
Well, we're not
that really
giving,
does it end, boy.
Not giving you any back talk and sass. We're supposed to open tomorrow.
Well,
and
saying that, what are the kids doing out on a major highway like this? That's no way to talk to a uniformed upholder of the law. You know that.
I think he's probably right, Harry.
Now, you see, you don't have
Thank
an inspection
you.
On this this bus. It caught my eye as you went by. I was dozing down there on back Billerica. You guys went by, and I picked you up out of the corner of my eye. This is an old bus.
I've been keeping the speed down to 55, though, officer. I've been very careful to follow the government's mandate.
You see, this bus hasn't had a safety check in years. You see, you're supposed to have a thing right here in your windshield.
Well, Mr. Marlowe back there was supposed to take care of it. Greg?
Yeah?
The officer says there's no inspection sticker on this Mal Hallett bus.
Well, don't hang it on me. You're the driver.
You arranged to hire it, didn't you?
You're the driver. Talk him out of it. Do something.
Yes, Harry, do something, for heaven's sakes.
And so a police officer stops the bus carrying our friends to Meredith, New Hampshire. Will they be able to continue on their way? Or be delayed in opening Westchester Furioso? Be sure to join us tomorrow when we'll hear Calvin say,
"What are you putting cuffs on us for?"
That's tomorrow in the next exciting episode of Mary Backstage Noble One. Word Car, speak.
And that was an episode of Mary Backstage Noble Wife from Bob and Ray sometime in the 70s. Direct inspiration for our later serial known as the Tripods. And that aired in the 70s, but it was actually a continuation of a series that I believe started way back in the 50s. And it sounded very different then. I think what happened was they did this as a comedy team back then in the 50s and then renewed it again in the 70s with a different sound. I'd like to play a very brief episode from the 50s because that ties into what influenced this particular series, which is also pretty fascinating and interesting, and that would be the last chapter in this saga. But let's listen to an episode of Mary Backstage Noble Wife from Bob and Ray from the, I believe, the 1950s. It may even be earlier than that.
For the many fans who wait for her on the radio, we present once again the interesting story, Mary Backstage, Noble Wife. The story of a young girl from a deserted mining town out west who comes to New York to try to find romance and security as the wife of handsome Harry Backstage, Broadway star. What it means to be the wife of the idol of a million other women. Just as we left our friends at the Coliseum, Pop had called Harry and Calvin to say that Sming Smog the skunk had escaped. Harry and Calvin quickly rushed back, and now as they joined Pop, amidst a feeling of excitement, we hear.
What's the matter? You say he broke out of his cage?
You mean he's not here anymore?
Well, Freddy.
Well, here he goes. Down that way.
Hey, through that aisle there. Come on, after him.
Well, this is terrible.
He Look at the
away
people.
Now, we'll never be able to get our money from the contract.
Place is in an uproar.
A mere riot.
Look, he's heading for the escalator.
Uh-oh.
Off the escalator, everybody.
Ring Smog the skunk is on the escalator.
Off the escalator.
I'll head up the down escalator and head him off.
Can't, sir.
Can't get anywhere that
Can't
way.
Can't get up that way.
Yeah, that's right.
Hey.
There he goes.
He's coming down. He's coming down, everybody.
He's coming down.
Look at him go.
He doesn't like captivity, obviously.
No, sir.
There he is. He went through the swinging doors.
Oh, come on. Let's get after him. Officer?
What do you want?
Help us follow that skunk.
Which one? There's a million in this spot.
No, the one there. The real one.
Oh, that one.
I've lost sight of him, Harry.
So have I.
You see him, Calvin?
Yes, he just went across the street. He's over by Central Park. Oh!
He's not going into Central Park. He's heading down Central Park South.
There's only one thing to do now. It's call the United States Army.
All right.
You're the only ones who can help us.
Well, where's the telephone?
Where's the telephone back of the Coliseum?
I'll run back and do that.
There he goes. There he goes into the Hampshire House.
Well, come on, after him. chase is on. Ming's Fogg has escaped, and Harry and Calvin are after him while Pop goes to phone the United States Army. Be sure and listen tomorrow, and we'll hear Calvin Hoogevin say...
Look, he went right into the Park Chambers. He's standing right beside Victor Flood.
That's tomorrow in the next exciting episode of Mary Backstage, Noble Wife, Weird Carr speaking.
Okay. That theme's a bit much, but wow, the world those guys can create just with a bunch of sound effects and two people going back and forth in different voices. It simply was amazing. It was captivating, and it really captured my imagination and made me want to listen more and eventually made me want to create stuff like that. But the final chapter of this little odyssey here goes back even before the first episode of Mary Backstage, Noble Wife by Bob and Ray. Now, you might think that's rather an odd title, and there's a reason for that. Because actually, Mary Backstage, Noble Wife is a play on a real serial. Not a mock serial, but a real serial known as Mary Noble Backstage Wife. Yeah, this was a dramatic series that aired, I think, every day on the radio, and people all over the country would be riveted listening to this. And I'll bet nobody listening now even remembers or has ever heard an episode of this particular serial until now. That's right. We actually were able to find a copy of this particular radio serial, which I don't know when it aired. I think it might have been the 1940s or maybe the 1950s. But Mary Noble Backstage Wife. And let's... see if we can actually play this thing.
And now, Backstage Wife, the story of Mary Noble and what it means to be the wife of a famous star. As the long last days before Larry Noble's trial for the murder of Oliver Wilson drag on, Mary is grateful that the misunderstanding between her and her husband Larry has been eased, and that Larry is once again convinced that his wife is not romantically interested in wealthy Rupert Barlow. And Mary has no way of knowing that Rupert Barlow is determined to break up her marriage with Larry so that Mary will pay closer attention to him. Right now, after an absence of more than a day, we find Mary entering the small New York hotel in the theater district where she's been staying. And as she approaches the desk, we hear...
Mrs. Noble, you don't know how glad I am to see you.
Why, thank you, Mr. Burns. It's nice to be back.
We were just about to give you up. And the calls we've had... It's kept the switchboard busy, I can tell you.
Any calls for me?
Just about all the time. We didn't even know you'd left till we tried to call your room.
I can't imagine who would be calling me so frantically. It wasn't my friend Miss Marlowe, was it? I told her I'd be out on Long Island over Christmas with friends and with my young son, Larry Jr.
We haven't had a chance to talk to your friend Miss Marlowe.
Oh, she's very busy, you know. She's been rehearsing with a play that just opened.
Yes. We've all been watching the notices, Mrs. Noble. It looks like Miss Marlowe has got a hit this time.
Yes, I'm sure of it. But what about all those calls for me? They can't have come from my husband because I've just been with him. And my son was all right a few hours ago.
The calls were from Mr. Barlow.
Oh.
He insisted he had to reach you. Well, I tried my best to explain that we didn't know where you were, but he just wouldn't believe us. The way he carried on was something awful.
Can't imagine why he'd be calling me, Mr. Burns.
Well, there's a package for you. We put it in the safe. It came just before noon on Christmas Day, Mrs. Noble, by bonded messenger. So I signed for it and put it in the safe. Just a minute. I'll get it for you.
That still doesn't explain about all those calls.
Just 1 minute till I get the package. It's right in here. Oh, there you are. It must be very valuable, judging by all the fuss over it.
Thanks. I can't imagine what this is all about.
Well, about the middle of the afternoon, Mrs. Noble, on Christmas Day, Mr. Barlow started to call. First he said that he had to reach you. Then he said that I was to take this package that had come for you and keep it. He said he'd send for it and that you were under no circumstances to be allowed to open it.
Well, that's utterly fantastic. Are you sure this really was Mr. Barlow? I don't understand.
Well, he said he was Mr. Barlow. That's all I know. And he was very rude, Mrs. Noble. Of course, I told him that I couldn't do anything about the package that had come for you by bonded messenger. I had it in the safe, and that's where it was going to stay until you called for it.
It's all very bewildering, but thank you all the same. I'm sorry to have caused so much trouble.
Just one thing more, Mrs. Noble. If you'll be good enough to sign for this package.
Oh, yes, of course, Mr. Burns.
Right here. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Shall I put through a call for Mr. Barlow now, or what?
I'll wait until I get to my room.
Well, just as you say, Mrs. Noble. If he should phone, shall I connect you?
Yes. That is... Yes, I guess so.
Well, just so I know. Mr. Barlow is a very disagreeable man when he's put off. He seemed to think I was deliberately keeping him from reaching you. I do hope you'll tell him that I had no way of knowing where you were. No way at all.
Yes, of course, Mr. Burns. You were quite right about everything.
Well, how do you like that? Just grabs the jewelry box and goes for the elevator. I'd give a lot to know what's in that box and why Rupert Barlow's so anxious to get his hands on it. Millie, be sure to listen in if he calls. Let me know what it's all about.
Miss Mary Noble goes to her room, puzzled and uneasy. She clutches the small jewel box in her hand. Meantime, in the familiar visiting room of the New York City jail, Larry Noble finds a most surprising visitor in the person of Julia Dixon, Rupert Barlow's secretary. And as Larry enters the room and the guard closes the door, we hear...
Hello, Mr. Noble. I suppose you're surprised to find me here.
As a matter of fact, I am, Miss Dixon. I hardly thought I'd have the pleasure of your company in this wretched place.
I don't suppose I'll be very welcome.
Why not? It was nice of you to trouble. Did you come all the way from Barlow's house on Long Island?
Yes. I thought about it all night long. I couldn't sleep a wink. This morning I made up my mind that I had to come here and let you know what's happening while you're being kept here a prisoner.
That sounds rather ominous, Miss Dixon. I hope I'm wrong about it.
It all depends, Mr. Noble, on how much you care about your wife and the way she's carrying on behind your back.
I'm sure you must know that I'm deeply devoted to my wife. And I have every confidence that she's entirely able to conduct herself with perfect dignity at all times.
Very high-sounding speech, Mr. Noble. But how much of that do you really believe? Haven't you heard any of the gossip? Don't you see the papers? Is everything being kept from you?
I'm free to read all the newspapers, Miss Dixon.
Then surely you've seen the pictures of your wife and Rupert Barlow.
Yes.
And you don't see anything wrong with that? Even though Marty Rufus openly states that they're having a flaming romance during the time you're being held here, waiting for your trial?
Suppose you get to the point, Miss Dixon.
Very well, I shall. You know my position in Mr. Barlow's household only too well.
I know that you've managed his estate on Long Island, and very capably, for 10 years.
10 years of waiting to become Mrs. Rupert Barlow, instead of being just his housekeeper.
I'm sorry you feel so bitterly about the man, Miss Dixon. But at the same time, I don't see how it concerns...
I'll tell you why I'm here. You can judge for yourself if there's nothing serious between Rupert and your wife.
I can tell you right now, Miss Dixon, that I don't want to hear any stories about my wife. If you have any grievances against your employer, Mr. Barlow, that's your misfortune. But it's no reason to drag my wife into the picture.
You think not? Then let me tell you something, Mr. Noble, something I'm sure you don't know. Christmas Day, Rupert came home to Oyster Bay, tried to make me believe that everything was quite as it had been, even though he scarcely spent 10 hours at home since you were arrested.
Miss Dixon, if you don't
mind... Please let me finish. We were sitting quietly in the library. It was before dinner. Rupert was very attentive and sweet. He gave me a present, Mr. Noble. It was a very expensive present. To be exact, it was a square-cut emerald bracelet. I have it here.
Well, that's very nice, I must say, but what it has to do with me, I...
Well, here's the card that came with it, Mr. Noble. I want you to read it.
Well, all right, but I still don't see, Mr.
Please read it out loud.
Very well. To Mary, the loveliest woman in all the world.
Now do you understand why I'm here, Mr. Noble?
How did you get this, Miss Dixon? How does it happen that you have this card?
It's quite simple. The jeweler made a mistake. The box that was meant for your wife came to me instead.
I see.
I can only suppose my present was sent to your wife.
Well, it's all very disturbing. I don't know quite what to say.
I'm sure you don't. Neither did I. Rupert tried his best to get this away from me, but I wouldn't let him. I wanted you to see this, to know once and for all what's happening.
Very kind of you, I'm sure, Miss Dixon.
It's better to know the truth, even if it hurts. I've known for months that Rupert's been infatuated with Mary. He hasn't tried to hide the fact. Now he's proved just how important this romance has become. A bracelet like this is more than just a trinket, Mr. Noble. I'm sure you know that.
Yes, I know that.
To think that anyone could be so cruel when you're in such desperate trouble. Oh, perhaps it's not entirely your wife's fault, Mr. Noble. Rupert can be so devastating. I know that only too well. He has everything, power, charm, tremendous wealth, and he doesn't hesitate to use them all to get anything he wants. No one is held out against him, not for long. I think it's obvious that he's made another conquest.
Do you mind if we don't say any more? I'll call the guard.
Of course. I'll go at once. Maybe you'd like to keep this card.
No, I don't want to see it again.
I'll leave it here on the table. You may want to reconsider. I'm sorry to bring you such bad news, Mr. Noble, at a time like this. It isn't easy for me to bear either. Goodbye.
Larry Noble looks at the hateful card on the table. After several seconds, he picks it up and puts it in his pocket. At the same time, Mary is in her hotel room, her mysterious package on the table beside the bed. Now she picks it up and removes the wrapping and glances at the jewel inside the box.
A ruby pendant. How in the world did that come to me? Oh, here's the card. Merry Christmas to Julia with love and devotion, Rupert. No wonder he's been calling here. Well, he must be absolutely frantic. But how did it get here in the first place? How could anyone make such a mistake? It's a good thing I came back when I did. I still can't figure it out. It's certainly Rupert Barlow's Christmas present to Julia, but how could it come to me? And the clerk said it came by bonded messenger. Oh, it's fantastic. I wonder what I should do. Should I call Rupert? No, he's bound to phone again. And when he does, I'll tell him that his present to Julia is safe. Oh, thank heaven Larry doesn't know about this mistake. I've got to get it back to Rupert without having anyone else know.
Mary Noble closes the jewel box and puts it back on the table, still baffled by the mystery. But confident it can be straightened out in short order. We'll be sure to be listening tomorrow to Backstage Wife, the story of Mary Noble and her husband Larry Noble, famous Broadway star.
Okay, that certainly wants to makes you want to listen to 1,000 more episodes of that and find out just what happened. Consider this, back then, whenever that was pretty much the entertainment that you had. Yeah, that and going to the movies maybe on the weekends. But there was no TV to speak of, and there wasn't a whole lot of variety. And it's important to preserve that. But anyway, the reason I played all this was just to sort of tell a story within a story of how something that meant something to somebody else was inspired by something else that meant something to me, which in turn was inspired by something else which I had never heard of. Yeah, and it's just a fascinating world when things like that can happen. But we've exhausted the subject, and I don't want to talk about it anymore, so let's move on to other things going on in the world. And we have a limited amount of time, so let's try and get through as much as we can. Here we go again. Our local newspaper, Newsday, is just, I'm sorry, it's a bastion of racism. It's turned into that. And the reason for this is because they legitimize all these ignorant idiots who feel they have to say their particular racist bit, and Newsday basically allows them all to have their say. They're not printing the letters in the newspaper. I think maybe if they were doing that, people would realize, hey, this isn't a good thing. This isn't a good thing. And have some editor control here. But they're doing this on their website. They're having pretty much full-fledged commentary on any story, and every story seems to involve racism and nasty things being said. I'll give you an example. This is something that happened last week. A small group of protesters marched Tuesday in front of Manor Haven Village, Manhattan Village Hall, that is, protesting what they said were racist comments made by the mayor. The Latino demonstrators were responding to comments by Mayor Nicholas Capozzi, who called Hispanic residents Spaniolis and called the sections of the village where they lived I'm unclear about this. It says a dash 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 hole. So I'm not sure if there's supposed to be something inserted there to make a word which I'd rather not say, which I believe I can say, but I'm not going to say it. Or does it mean a pause? Like, they live in a hole, you know? I don't know. It's not clear. Anyway, this is according to a taped conversation he had with a local contractor. Apparently the local contractor taped him for some reason. The 10 demonstrators who said they were undocumented construction workers held American flags and signs saying, Amamos America, we love America. Capozzi is a racist, stop the hate. And Nostras no somos Spaniolis, we are not Spaniolis. Drivers passing on Manor Haven Boulevard honked and gave thumbs-up signals or pumped their fist in the air, apparently expressing support for the protesters. One Salvadoran man who has lived in Manor Haven since 1981 said, we pay taxes like everybody else. Why is he a wise guy about us? Another man came to Manor Haven from Mexico 9 years ago. He declined to give his name because he's undocumented. Said, the mayor doesn't want Spanish people working here. I don't understand it. We pay taxes like everybody else. To me, it's not fair for him to call us names. Capozzi could not be reached for comment last week. Basically, the quote reads as follows. The Spaniolis are rolling all over the place. And there's more dashes there, so maybe he used a word there. They rent out the place and put locks on every door. It's got to stop. Do you drive down... Oh, I guess these are curses that the dashes represent. Do you drive down that dashing block? It looks like dashing Harlem. It looks worse than Harlem. Oh, I get it now. It's a dashing hole over there. Okay, now it makes sense. Not what he says, but the way it's being portrayed here. Capozzi denied making the comments when initially asked about them, but then when he found out there was a tape, he said, oh, okay, well, the word Spagnoli was not derogatory. Good save there, Capozzi. Good save. Manor Haven's become increasingly diverse in the last decade. Nearly a quarter of its population is now Latino, and more power to them, I say. Some of the comments fielded on Newsday. The truth hurts. This is too funny. What is wrong with what he said? It's all true. Did you ever see the way these pigs live? They are nothing but disgusting animals who live as such. People need to stop reacting so hypersensitive about every little comment. Because that's a really tiny comment you just made there. It's out of control. If you can't handle the fact that no one wants them here, they don't live here. Then don't live here. People can't handle the truth. What else? God forbid someone calls a spade a spade. I know that's not a racist remark, this person claims. Okay, I guess that makes it not a racist remark. Everything is great with this world. No one is a dirty pig. No one is responsible for their own actions. It's all someone else's fault, right? What a joke. It's funny how someone would say that defending this guy. As much as it may have been the truth, I predict he'll be making an apology soon just to try to pacify the PC jerks that think anything that is said must meet their perfect pattern. The Reverend Al is currently map-questing Manor Haven. That's actually kind of funny, but why does Reverend Al get all the heat when you have idiots like this running around saying this kind of garbage? You need 100 Reverend Al's to pacify them. Another Newsday listener, or Newsday reader comment, close the borders, deport the illegals now, give the mayor a medal of honor for speaking the truth. How much more of this garbage are we going to stand for, America? Call your senators and congressmen now and tell them we've had enough of this. Enough of what? People? My God. It's incredible, too. If you talk to the people who are all anti-illegal immigration, just dig a little deeper. You'll find they're anti-immigration, too. Too many people of Spanish descent. Too many people that aren't like us. And there's a story that happened over the weekend. Los Angeles, there is... Actually, on May 1st, there is a big demonstration nationwide, and there was one in Los Angeles as well, basically demonstrating for immigration rights and more ability to immigrate into the country, something that I think is a good thing if people actually want to live here. The LA cops just basically attacked the crowd. They attacked the crowd, women, children, peaceful people just standing there. And the reaction to this has been pretty good, actually, by Los Angeles. The LAPD, they've been firing cops. They've been really coming down hard on the people who instigated the violence, and it was the cops. I wish New York was reacting like this after 2004. So this is a good thing, the reaction. What happened was horrible, and hopefully the people will be duly compensated for whatever they had to go through. But reading the story in Newsday again, you see all kinds of racial epithets and people saying, you know, it's about time somebody cracked their heads and got rid of these people who are demonstrating so that they can be here legally. It's really, it's pretty sick of the world we're living in right now. And nothing demonstrates it more than this kind of action and the kind of reaction that so many of us still continue to have. It really is shocking, no question about it. very close-minded, violent type of society that's evolving in front of us. And you look over at events in France, where they just had an election. They just elected a very conservative president. And the socialists have lost. Well, there's rioting going on. Yeah, you know, they have rioting. If the weather doesn't turn out quite the way they like it, there's rioting in Paris. I mean, that's just, it's part of the culture. It's part of the culture. And at one point, it was part of our culture. That's right. It was part of our culture to protest. And sometimes protests got a little out of hand. There was rioting and cars were burning and things like that started to happen. That, we can't even conceive of that anymore. The flip side, back then when there was rioting going on, right here, in fact, right here at the State University of Stony Brook, this was sort of a hotbed for riots against the Vietnam War and against all sorts of U.S. policy. You would have things exploding. You would have buildings burning. You would have cars on fire. Not a lot of violence. I don't consider that kind of thing violence. I consider that destruction, property destruction. Very different. But it was part of the culture then that sometimes things got out of hand. And sometimes maybe it even was necessary. Yeah, sometimes a burning car might actually get people to address the issues and wake up. It's not a pleasant thing, but sometimes that's what happens. But now we live in a world here where it's conceivable for somebody to just walk into a classroom and open fire with a machine gun, and we live in fear of that particular event occurring. A riot? No, that's impossible. A riot is the furthest thing from our minds, despite all the nonsense that's happening out there, despite all the things that people should be getting angry about. They've become complacent. They believe that they don't have any power to affect any kind of change. And that's been programmed into them, as well as the fear that's been programmed into them from all the violence and all the access to guns that has exploded over the past 20, 30, 40 years. It's simply incredible. I'm sorry, we're running out of time, so we only have time for one shooting. I'm sorry. I like to spend time on all the shootings of the week, but we're just going to have to do one, okay? I'm sorry. We'll make up for it next week. Police say they arrested the college student suspected of shooting three people yesterday at Fresno State University. Police initially believed the suspect was still in the apartment complex, but they expanded the search after determining he had slipped away. This is not another Virginia Tech, said police spokesman Jeff Cardinal. This is simply a dispute between one person and a group of individuals. Oh, okay. Oh, thank God. You know, I thought this guy running around shooting people in a college, I thought it was another random thing. But because he knew the people and was shooting people that he knew, his friends, his colleagues, wow, what a sigh of relief. Thank God. Our society's under control. Let's see. Six different apartments were cordoned off Tuesday as police examined evidence in a hallway at the Poolside complex. A man with a bloody bandage on his left shoulder, who described himself as one of the victims, told the AP the dispute started, get this, when he and the other victims accused the gunman of stealing a PlayStation video game console. And the guy who shot us, he had stolen from our apartment. We had to confront him with the evidence, and it just turned ugly from there. He pulled the gun out on us. He fired five or six times. And one of his friends said she was his ex-girlfriend, described him as a fine, normal, goofy, silly teen who wanted to be a parole officer. Well, folks, when these fine, goofy, normal people get their hands on weapons of death, what do you think is going to happen when things get a little bit out of control? You have to ask yourself, which society is better, that with an occasional burning car, or that with so many people having access to death at a moment's notice and exercising it? Okay, send us your hate mail or comments or criticisms or ideas, suggestions, otw@2600.com. We're out of time, unfortunately, but we'll be back again with another exciting edition of Off the Wall next week at this time. And tomorrow night on Off the Hook is another fundraiser, so please tune in to that. Emmanuel Goldstein for Off the Wall. Have a good night.
A young cowboy named Billy Joe grew restless on the farm. A boy filled with wanderlust who really meant no harm. He changed his clothes and shined his boots and combed his dark hair down. And his his mother cried as he walked out, "Don't take your guns to town, son. Leave your guns at home, Bill. Don't take your guns to town." He laughed and kissed his mom and said, "You're Billy Joe's a man. I can shoot as quick and straight as anybody can. But I wouldn't shoot without a cause. I'd gun nobody down." But she cried again as he rolled away. "Don't take your guns to town, son. Leave your guns at home, Bill. Don't take your guns to town." He sang a song as on he rode, his guns hung at his hips. He rode into a cattle town, a smile upon his lips. He stopped and walked into a bar and laid his money down. But his mother's words echoed again, "Don't take your guns to town, son. Leave your guns at home, Bill. Don't take your guns to town." He drank his first strong liquor then to calm his shaking hand and tried to tell himself at last he had become a man. A dusty cowpoke at his side began to laugh him down, and he heard again his mother's words, "Don't take your guns to town, son. Leave your guns at home, Bill. Don't take your guns to town." Filled with rage, then Billy Joe reached for his gun to draw. But the stranger drew his gun and fired before he even saw. As Billy Joe fell to the floor, the crowd all gathered round and wondered at his final words, "Don't take your guns to town, son. Leave your guns at home, Bill. Don't take your guns to town."
Hi, this is Albert Collins. When I'm out in Stony Brook, I'll be listening to WUSB FM station. When I want to listen to some good blues, that's the station you tune into.